Hi, this is the Writing Excuses team.
Hi.
We podcast at writingexcuses.com. And we've been asked to do a special podcast for you guys talking about how being LDS intersects with our art and how it influences our art. I'm Brandon Sanderson. I write epic fantasy novels.
I'm Dan Wells. I write supernatural thrillers.
I'm Howard Taylor. I write science fiction webcomic.
Okay. So, and we are all active LDS members of the LDS Church.
Yes, we are.
So, how does being LDS affect us? Howard, how does it affect you?
Artistically.
Oh, well, there you go.
You can't just say it sends me to heaven. That.
There is a sacred aspect to what I do. Mm-hmm. I am creating something, and I mean most artists create something and believe that it's important and believe that that you know maybe they found their calling in life. For me, it's a sacred thing. The act of creating my comic, of writing and illustrating this, is precious and cherished, and in some small measure, godlike. And sometimes I joke about that. You know, I'm the god of the Schlock Mercenary universe. But it's...
That makes you a very capricious god.
Yeah.
It is a horrible, horrible place to live. It's the driving law of that universe is not, we are created to live happily. It's that we are created so that there will be a punchline.
Yeah. The first law of heaven is, I will kill you if it's funny.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. Dad, how about yourself? How can you follow that?
I don't have anything to follow that. I do believe, you know, in the LDS Church, one of the big things is gifts, you know, and what talents we have and how we are supposed to share them with others. And I do very strongly believe that writing is a talent that I have and that I have a responsibility to develop it and to use it well and to use it for a purpose. Which is not to say that I try to write didactically, but I do think that the things that I write, you know, that I can say something, that I can speak to people, that I can present something that will matter.
I think that's a big part of it for me too. That as I explored who I am and what I, you know, what I was good at, you know, it seems like a lot of things in my psychological and physical makeup have pushed me to do what I do. Mm-hmm. And it's the whole thing of I've been given a talent, so make good on it. Interestingly, people pick out far more LDS themes in my work than I notice. It usually takes someone else noticing it before I notice it. And then I say, oh, wow, that's totally LDS. Mm-hmm. But I don't go into my work actively making any aspect of it LDS.
You're not trying to shape a Mormon universe.
Right. But, you know, if you look at who I am and what my mythology is, so to speak, using that in the, you know, definitional sense of it, not looking at it as a mythology is untrue. It's just what my mythology is, what my belief in how things work is influences what I do when I write and when I make. And so I end up making these fantasy worlds that do have some core underlying LDS style mythology.
Yeah. I was describing to my father-in-law the other day a new project I was working on, which is kind of an apocalyptic science fiction thing, and he said, well, now, how can you write that knowing that it isn't true? You know, knowing that it isn't actually going to happen that way. Doesn't that just ruin the whole thing for you? And no, it doesn't, because, you know, I'm not trying to convey a religious truth in everything I write. What I'm trying to do is, you know, take a situation and then present it, you know, how will the characters react to that? And inevitably, my religious beliefs come through, mm-hmm. Often, like you say, without me even being aware of it. But, you know, those themes will keep cropping up just because that's the way the characters are responding to a fantastical situation.
The truth in genre fiction, whether you're writing horror or, you know, near future sci-fi or, mm-hmm. you know, far-flung space opera, the truth is not to be found anywhere in the setting. The truth is to be found in how the characters respond to the setting. And there are important, far-reaching, dare I say, eternal truths to be found in how we describe the way our characters respond.
I think that is what initially attracted me to genre fiction in the first place. Orson Scott Card has famously said that science fiction and fantasy is the most religious genre that we have. And I agree because of what you're talking about.
I always like to say that when I'm writing fiction, science fiction and fantasy, one of the things I like about it is, you know, in scientific experiments, you have a control. One thing, you know, things that you try not to change so that you can narrow down what is actually changing, what's affecting. And normally, you know, you'll try to control everything except for the one factor you're trying to test for. But not necessarily. Sometimes you'll only, you know, you won't control several things or whatnot. I always say that my control, the thing that I don't change when I write my stories is human experience and human nature. How people respond and how they react is what I keep as my constant, so that when you pick up this book and I change everything else, including the laws of physics, who a person is still a person to you when you're reading the book. And that allows for that control. And that way we can experiment wildly with experience and setting and world and laws and everything, so that we can see how people respond. But it's not about always predicting what's going to happen. I mean, if you look at George Orwell, this may be urban myth, honestly, but I've heard several times told the story about 1984, that he originally wanted to name it 1948, and that he was persuaded to name it 1984 to make it more science fiction-y, to remove it from experience. But he wasn't saying, this is what I think the future will be like. He was saying, here is a danger, and here is what happens if that danger is taken to extremes, and let's look at what that does to people and society. And so it doesn't, you know, people, there are some people out there that think all fantasy is contrary to religious truth, because by nature, it's not real.
Though I think this is a good place to note that sentiment, while it is very common in a lot of Christian churches, is relatively rare in the LDS faith.
It is.
For whatever reason, our Christian church is far more accepting of fantasy fiction than the majority of other religions.
My agent sent me a news article, and I might be quoting it wrong, but said that the Jordan Landing Cinema was the number two cinema in the United States for sales of Harry Potter tickets. A couple weeks ago.
Wow.
And he asked me, so did you guys all enjoy this movie? Because, you know, he likes to pay attention to things like that. And statistically, we bought more tickets to Harry Potter per capita than anyone else in the entire country.
That's funny. You know, it's interesting. I've been approached before where people look at what I write and they look at my faith and they ask, I guess, you know, kind of the same question your father-in-law asked you. How do you reconcile these two? And I try to explain, I'm not creating a future that I believe to exist. I'm not creating a universe that I believe to be real. I'm creating a universe that I believe will be fun for me to tell a story in. You know, trying to write a near future science fictional universe in which, you know, let's make it very, very LDS, very, very Christian, in which prophecies are being fulfilled and the big reveal is that Christ is returning. That could be a very powerful work of fiction. I don't dare write it.
Yeah.
I don't dare write it because there's so many things that I would get wrong and there's so many things that I would want to take liberty with in order to tell a good story. And people would point at it and say, well, that's obviously wrong. That's, you know, heretic / apostate / you know, whatever else.
Yeah.
And I don't know how interesting the story would be. The setting is one that we're actually all fairly familiar with. The interesting part would be what the characters would do.
Yeah.
So if I want to take the characters and I want to throw them into apotheotic apocalypse, How's that for alliteration?
You know,
apotheotic apocalypse.
An apotheotic apocalypse.
Apothecary is your character.
If I want to do that, then I'll do it with a fictional god and a fictional apocalypse where I can control all of the details and get them internally consistent without necessarily getting them right or wrong per
according
somebody
to
else's
an objective
belief system.
Center somewhere. Every local convention that we go to, and Utah has tons, aspiring writers always come up to the three of us, and because they're familiar with the podcast and they ask us for advice and questions. Inevitably, at every one of these, there's always at least one person who is writing that story. Mm-hmm. The science fiction Second Coming book.
And that's because
I always get very leery when I hear them.
Because the Christian one, what was it called?
The Left Behind.
Left Behind was so big.
Which was huge and was apparently very good. And I think that there's definitely room for that. Mm-hmm. And I think if it was written really well, it would be accepted. But I'm with Howard. I wouldn't dare write it myself.
The science fiction near future apocalypse that I loved was Orson Scott Card's Folk of the Fringe, in which we have a post-apocalyptic United States in which Jesus has not come back yet. And how do the Mormons respond? And
that
was powerful fiction. Mm-hmm. That was really powerful stuff.
Now, I introduced myself at the beginning by saying that I write supernatural thrillers. That's because I write horror, but the word horror freaks people out, and then everyone thinks that I write slasher movies. And I don't. But one of the best comments that I ever got at a signing was somebody came up to me in California, and he kind of sidled up to me and he said, "You're LDS, right? Yeah. Well, I'm LDS too, and I wanted to ask you a question. I would like to write horror like you, but I want to know, am I going to lose my recommend if I do it?" And he just because of the stigma the genre has, he was kind of halfway convinced that his membership in the church was going to be at risk if he started writing
on sleeping with
fiction.
Your agent.
Because other than that, and this is a question that I don't get in that form very often, but a lot of people wonder about, and you know, it's. I don't see any discrepancy between writing horror fiction and my faith. Neither does my bishop or stake president or anybody else. That said, I know a lot of science fiction, LDS science fiction authors that get, you know, their stake president has a file of all the complaint letters.
That's what we've heard.
I
don't know
letters.
If it's true. I've heard it for Orson Scott Card that he has one. Oddly, no one even asks me. Once in a blue moon, you know, someone in an email seems curious about this. There's something about writing fantasy that's okay. Maybe it's C.S. Lewis. It's probably C.S. Lewis.
Quite possibly.
That makes it okay. C.S. Lewis and Tolkien make it all right to do fantasy, whereas horror or even science fiction seem like, oh, those godless atheists.
I get email once every couple of months from somebody who says, so your church is okay with you writing science fiction? Well, yes. Quite. It's fine. It's all
Though,
good.
Do you guys self-edit on content because of your LDS?
I self-edit on content because that's the comic strip I want to read. Distinguishing between whether that's what I want to read because I've been brought up LDS and I have, if not a squeaky clean lifestyle and character, at least squeakier and cleaner than maybe a lot of others, or whether that's because, you know, I have a set of guidelines that I want to adhere to. It's hard to split hairs on that. But yes, I self-edit a lot. There's every other strip, I feel like there's the opportunity for somebody to use some sort of epithet or profanity, and I don't want to because I think it's more interesting if they use in-world epithets that are funnier. And as I do my wordsmithing, I realize that those things don't strengthen don't strengthen the prose at all. They don't strengthen the prose. I'm not writing prose. They don't strengthen the dialogue.
I don't self-edit content, but I do self-edit level of graphic nature. Saying that someone is naked is different from going into
a detailed explanation of how naked
and so
they are.
I will include the nudity. I will not give the description. And that's kind of where I go. And there is no point where I've ran into something in a book that I said, I'm not going to write that conceptually. I've certainly have edited, decided how deeply I go into explaining something.
Mm-hmm.
And what a focus I make things. For instance, you know, there are instances specifically in my books where I've left open to reader interpretation whether characters are having premarital sex or not. I don't say because I don't want to make an issue of it. And that allows some readers to say, oh, they certainly are, because they would be in this situation.
Yeah.
And other readers to say, well, I don't want them to, because it's not part of my worldview, and I want to empathize with them, so I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to think it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that on occasion. Sometimes I just say, yes, they have, because that's the characters they are. And sometimes I say, no, they haven't.
Yeah, I've never written comics at any length on the sexual predilections of the vast majority of the grunts in Tagon's Tufts.
Right.
And there's quite a bit of speculation.
Yes, though you have with Elf and Kevin.
I have with Elf and Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
And where the romance has been important to the plot,
yep.
I've called it out.
Yep.
But
you had the
as to whether or not the Tufts visit brothels from time to time in order to fulfill their soldierly needs.
it's not a story you feel the need to tell.
It's not a story I felt the soldierly need to tell.
Yeah. I don't think that I have specifically edited myself ever for religious reasons. I don't tend to include a lot of profanity just because I don't use profanity for the most part. One of the issues I ran into with the serial killer series, serial killer psychology is inherently sexual. It's an inescapable part of how a sociopath becomes a killer in almost every single case. And I left that out of the series not because I objected to it religiously, but because I was writing for what I knew would be a largely teen audience. And I just wanted to... You know, so for that reason, I tried to keep it a little cleaner. You can still see a lot of it alluded to, especially in the second book, but it's never made as explicit as it would be if I were writing for adults.
Now, there was one instance I know specifically when, I can just tell the story. My wife had just finished reading your third book, I believe it was.
I know this story.
And we knelt down to have family prayer, and it was her turn. And she turned to me and said, I can't pray. Would you say it? She was so creeped out, she couldn't pray. And you thought that was awesome.
I did, and I'm probably going to hell for it. In fact, I would love to have that on the cover of the book, which would be fantastic.
So creepy, Brandon Sanderson's wife couldn't pray after reading the book.
Yeah, and I don't know how to respond to that, except that I'm just a bad person. You want, to some extent, you kind of want that really creepy reaction when you're writing a thriller, when you're writing a horror genre. I do think, personally, that overall, my three serial killer books, that trilogy, is very moral and, in fact, very redemptive.
Oh, overwhelmingly so.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the initial experience of that, yeah, if it creeps you out, hooray. If it creeps you out that much, I'll feel guilty, but I will still be happy about it.
If you've created something compelling, regardless of whether it's scary or suspenseful or fantastically immersive or speculative or whatever, if you've created something that is compelling, there are people who are not going to be able to collect their own thoughts for quite a period of time after having finished what it is that you read.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that they, you know, the voices in their head, you know, as they try and, you know, pray or, you know, mull over work or whatever, are going to keep coming out as, you know, allomantic or serial killerish or, amorph embodiment of violence and appetite, whatever. These things will consume you, And that's part of why we read them.
Yes.
We read them so that we can
Absolutely.
Have these other experiences without actually having to having to suffer the full suite of consequences.
Well,
for
and
them.
I think that that at its heart is, you know, why storytelling is so powerful is because it can take us somewhere we don't want to go. We can experience that horrible thing, and the deeper that pit becomes, the more profound our experience of crawling out of it at the end.
See, and I think it can take us up to the lofty heights as well.
Absolutely. Yes.
Which, you know, it's even better when it's not just crawling out of the pit. It's going straight up to climb that mountain. And you can have those experiences in fiction. And fiction just, it lets us do all kinds of things and explore all kinds of things. And you know, from an LDS perspective, I mean, yeah, I...
You know, yeah. When I was a kid, I read the Chronicles of Narnia, and I remember being just in awe of Aslan. And I had this thought one day. I thought, why don't I feel as strongly about Jesus as I do about Aslan right now? I was very troubled by that. I thought, man, why is Aslan more real to me, more powerful than Jesus is? Because that shouldn't be the case. Well, for starters, I'd been reading a lot more Narnia than I'd been reading scriptures. And secondly, thank you, C.S. Lewis, for calling my attention to the fact that my head was empty enough that Aslan could supplant the god I was supposed to be worshiping. And I struggled with that. You know, this is... 12 or 13-year-old Howard, I struggled with that
so this
long
was
enough to realize...
Early 40s?
Yeah. Shortly after he published the book.
Yes.
Yeah, come on. I am in my early 40s, I'll have you know.
Someone explained to you that Aslan is Jesus and you were okay?
No, and then I had already kind of figured out that metaphor. But what I realized is that that the awe I had for Aslan was supposed to be the awe and the worship that I had for Jesus, and I needed to build that relationship. And over the course of my life, I have. To the point that I look back at that moment and I say, again, you know, thank you, C.S. Lewis, for showing me what I should have been feeling and what, you know, someday I could be feeling.
All right, let's wrap this up just with suggesting to listeners who may not be familiar with our work what they should look into, perhaps. And start with you, Dan. You've mentioned Serial Killer. What's the title?
Okay, my series, the first book is called I Am Not a Serial Killer. It's about a 15-year-old sociopath. It actually won the 2010 Whitney Award for Best New Mormon Writer. So as creepy as you think it's going to be, it has been embraced by the LDS community.
Howard?
You can find my work. I write and illustrate Schlock Mercenary, which you can find online at schlockmercenary.com. If I had to give you a starting point, I think my favorite starting point right now is at the beginning of the massively parallel storyline, which is March of 2009. It's a fairly long arc, but it introduces you to all the characters. You don't have to read all 10 years of archives to catch up, because you know that's 3 weeks of your life you're just not getting back, and you need to do your home teaching.
Yes,
do your home teaching.
As an Elders Quorum president, do your home teaching.
I would say start with Warbreaker. To those listening right here, if you're interested in LDS themes and whatnot, because it's a book essentially about a world where people get turned into gods, and it's about one of the main characters is an agnostic god who does not believe in the religion that worships him, and it is about the nature of men being gods and what they do with that.
I would recommend Warbreaker because I think it's one of the most cheerful and colorful and upbeat of your books.
Okay, well, there we go.
Yes.
It's also free for download on my website, brandonsanderson.com. So that's cool. Well, this is, again, Writing Excuses. Please give us a listen if you're interested in writing concepts. It's a 15-minute podcast every week. writingexcuses.com.
Normally our podcasts are funnier than this one was.
Yeah, normally they're funnier, but normally Howard doesn't wear pants.
And now they're not going to invite us back.
So thank you, primarily Mormon audience, for listening to this.
Bye-bye.